Morning, we're reading after Shiva, lesson 25. What about evil, hell, and sin?
In the highest sense, there is no good or bad. God did not create evil as a force distinct from good. He granted to souls the divine laws of dharma and karma, along with the freedom to act as they wish, and the great ocean of experience. This is God's grace, allowing us to learn and evolve. There is no eternal hell, nor is there a Satan. However, there are hellish states of mind and painful births for those who think and act wrongfully. Sin is related only to the lower instinctive intellectual nature as a transgression of dharma. Man's true nature is not sullied by sin, and no bad deed can cause the soul to be forever lost or damned. Still, wrongful actions are real and to be avoided, for they return to us as sorrow through the law of karma. Bad deeds can be atoned for with sadhana, worship, and penance. As Saivites, we do not see a sharp contrast of good and evil in the world. Instead, we understand that all people have a threefold nature, instinctive, intellectual, and spiritual. The instinctive nature is the outer, lower, or animal nature of I, me, and mine. When it dominates, people become angry, fearful, greedy, jealous, and hurtful. The intellectual nature is the soul's mental aspect. When it rules, people can become arrogant and prone to argument and conflict. The spiritual or superconscious nature of the soul is the source of compassion, insight, modesty, peace, and understanding. The animal instincts of young souls are strong. Their intellect, which is needed to control the instincts, is yet to be developed. When we encounter meanness and wickedness in others, we recall this threefold nature and have compassion for those in the lower instinctive states. We know they will continue to evolve as they learn from their self-created karma. We also know there is no intrinsic evil. And Gurudeva's quote, Hinduism is such a joyous religion, freed of all the mental encumbrances that are prevalent in the various Western faiths. It is freed of the notion of a vengeful God. It is freed of the notion of eternal suffering. It is freed from the notion of original sin. That's good, right? When it comes to this topic, I always think about the interfaith event we had in Midland, Texas in 2012, because it was such a clear juxtaposition of the two different ideas about man's nature. The question we were answering was, in your faith, is humanity considered a one family? That's the question. My answer was, the Hindu belief that gives rise to tolerance of differences in race and nationality is that all of mankind is good. We are all divine beings, souls created by God. Hindus do not accept the concept that some individuals are evil and others are good. Hindus believe that each individual is a soul, a divine being, who is inherently good. Scriptures tell us that each soul is emanated from God as a spark from a fire, beginning a spiritual journey which will eventually lead them back to God. All human beings are on this journey, whether they realize it or not. And we had the Baptist minister, who we've known for many years, Dr. Randall Everett, gave his point of view, which is amazingly different. The idea of the oneness of humanity, this is where Christianity would differ from some of the religions. We do believe in the oneness of humanity, but that the oneness of humanity is that we are all a fallen people. I'll read that again. That's so different. We do believe in the oneness of humanity, but the oneness of humanity is that we are all a fallen people. We do not believe that we are inherently good. We believe we are inherently selfish and self-centered. And that's why we need to be rescued or redeemed. That Christ rescues us from the domain of darkness. Very different, right? Clearly, the Baptist theology is focusing on what we call the instinctive nature. They're not talking about the other two natures being there. We agree, instinctive nature has these qualities. Inherently selfish and self-centered. Yes, that's our instinctive nature, but we also believe that without anybody's external help, we also have an intellectual nature, and more importantly, a soul nature, which is who we really are. The other natures are just around us. So it's a very different idea altogether. The threefold nature, which is what this is focusing on in the last part, is a very good concept to understand ourselves as well as others. And as the text points out, the instinct gets controlled eventually by the intellect getting developed. So the intellect is very important in that that is what controls the instinct. But if we stop there, we're not a spiritual being yet, because the intellect, as this says, is prone to argumentation, intellectual pride. But we have to develop the soul nature, the spiritual qualities of compassion, devotion, to soften the intellect, put it in its place. I like to say the intellect is like a computer. A computer, particularly when it's attached to the internet, can be very distracting. Go all over the place. But the computer, when you use it in a disciplined way, is a great tool to get work done much more efficiently than you could without it. Therefore, the key to the intellect is the same. We need to use it in a disciplined way. As the computer is a tool for a disciplined person, so the intellect can be a useful tool for a disciplined soul. Something he can turn on and off when he needs it. You need to solve a mathematical problem, you turn on your intellect. Done with the problem, you turn it off. You don't want him running all day long, this constant analysis of life. Turn it on and off, just like you would a computer. Then intellect is a useful tool to us, and it's there to initially help us subdue the instinctive mind. So these three qualities we can see in ourselves. Therefore, if we start to get angry, we know that's our instinctive mind. If we do get angry, we know we can compensate for it. Through apology, through doing some penance, skipping a meal. If we do something wrong, we can get rid of it. We should never feel guilty about something we did. Hinduism is not a religion of guilt. If we did something and it makes us feel guilty, it means we haven't done enough penance. We haven't apologized to enough people. We don't want any sense of guilt. Guilt is not part of Hinduism. We're not trying to motivate members of the Hindu religion by making them feel guilty. We're trying to get rid of guilt. And likewise, in looking at others, we can see if they're upset and angry, that they're in the instinctive mind, and feel compassion toward them, realize that's just one part of their mind. They also have an intellect and a soul nature, and if we know them well, we can help them move out of that instinctive area. So therefore, we can understand our behavior and the behavior of others by referencing it to these three phases of the mind. Srinivasa calls them phases. how the mind functions. States of mind are like rooms in a building. Phases of the mind are how the mind functions. It functions instinctively, intellectually, or superconsciously. We can also call it intuitively if we want three I's. Instinctive, intellectual, and intuitive. Sometimes I do that in the keynote, end up with three I's. Another important point that this lesson makes is the idea of hell. It says very directly, there is no eternal hell. Because we did something or we didn't do something, Hindus don't go to an eternal hell. We don't believe that. Well, what is hell? Well, hell starts out, as does heaven, as a state of mind. State of mind in the present. Hell is states of mind, heaven is states of mind. Someone can be in hell right now because they're totally disturbed on the inside. Very constantly disturbed person, one reason or another. That's a hellish state of mind. We can be in a heavenly state of mind. We just come out of the temple, or in a heavenly state of mind. Or in heaven. Why do we say that? Because when we transition to the inner world, we're still the same person. It's just like walking into another room in your house. You're still the same person. You're just in another environment. But your consciousness is unchanged from what it was before you walked into that room. Therefore, if you were in a hellish state of mind before you walked into that room, you're still in a hellish state of mind. One of the qualities that Gurudeva describes for the inner worlds is that like is with like. It's just different than the earth. Different things are all spread out. But in the inner worlds, criminals gather together in the hellish states of mind part. Saints gather together in the heavenly state of mind part. So people gather together according to their natures in the inner worlds. But it's not different, really, than the state of mind you're in this world before you transition. You just have a continuity of consciousness. You don't become a different person just because you don't have a physical body. And then the last point, no Satan. What does that mean? It means there's no super villain, super force of evil. In Hinduism, we just have asuras. None of them is a super being. None of them is Satan. They're just asuras. They're beings that cause mischief. Temples have to have guards and protection so that asuras don't get in. It's very important. I remember Kumbhabhishekam was a very simple Kumbhabhishekam, small temple, and the priest was doing a homa, just one priest. And I've never seen someone put so much energy into creating protection. He just really, I think half an hour of ceremony was just devoted to protecting that homa from negative forces. Because it was a construction site. And he was very concerned about negativity coming in, disrupting the ceremony. So it's very important when you're out there, you know, in a construction site, there's no protection that's been created. We were advised, even for Iravan Temple, not to do homas there. We did homas there a couple times and we got scolded. Our staff, and he said, you can't do that, there's no protection. You haven't established protection. Fire attracts all kinds of beings. You can't just do a home of fire in an unprotected environment. It's not prudent. You can chant. It's fine to chant there, but you don't want to do the home of fire in an unprotected environment. And even if you created protection, the presence of construction there takes it away. Presence of the weather can take it away too. You don't do ceremonies very often. protection is needed to keep Asuras. But Asuras aren't, as I say, supervillains. They're just ordinary beings that take delight in causing mischief. It's interesting to watch children. I know some of the children in Malaysia, and one of them really liked delights in causing mischief. He's not an Asura. But he's awfully playful, shall we say, distracted by opportunities to cause mischief. Easily distracted by the opportunities to cause mischief. So not an Asura, but childish. If he's not serious, he enjoys causing mischief in situations. I'm sure you know some children like that too. Asuras are more than that, but they're nothing to be feared, but a temple needs to protect against them. That's, well, one of the reasons the temple feels so different is it has protection against certain beings and certain energies that you would feel in other places. Well, thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.